The following Dharma talk was recorded in February 2014 in Kansas City, Kansas. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called Awakening with Insight, Cultivating Concentration and Mindfulness, taught by Shyla Catherine and Phil Jones. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Shyla Catherine is the founder of Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. She has practiced meditation since 1980 with more than 8 years of accumulated silent retreat experience. Shyla has authored two books, Focused and Fearless, A Meditator's Guide to States of Deep Joy, Calm, and Clarity, and Wisdom Wide and Deep, A Practical Handbook for Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. Find out more about Shyla at www.imsb.org. Phil Jones has been teaching insight meditation since 1996. He has studied with teachers from Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society, and graduated from the first Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. Phil has served on Mid-America Dharma's Board of Directors since the mid-1990s. Find out more about Phil at www.silentmindopenheart.org.
Tonight's talk is on faith. The subtitle is Where the Heart Rests. There's one discourse of the Buddha that I'm quite fond of, where in this brief discourse, four modes of progress or four kinds of people are described. And one mode of progress is a mode that is slow and painful. Another mode is quick, but also painful. There's another mode that is slow but pleasant, and another one that is quick and pleasant. Now, I'm sure we would all prefer the latter one that's quick and pleasant, but we can't control the feeling tone or the rate at which our practice develops. Sometimes it may seem as though practice is very difficult, and sometimes it might seem as though we make great strides with hardly any effort. And some people might experience a dominance of either pain or pleasure and feel as though they're very much in one of these modes. And other times it seems like, well, this retreat was like that and a different retreat was like another mode. It varies a lot, but there's no need to worry because all four of these modes of progress lead to complete awakening. All four are liberating. We just need the faith to continue to slog along through patches that are slow or painful. In the Buddhist context, the factor of faith takes on a slightly more practical slant than it tends to in theistic religions. We simply don't worship the Buddha as a deity. In fact, we're not even encouraged to believe what the Buddha taught. We're instead encouraged to wisely consider what we hear as the teachings, to try to understand them, to reflect upon them, and to put them in practice enough that we can see for ourselves where they lead. Yet we only accept teachings after we discover for ourselves if indeed they do increase wholesome states and decrease unwholesome states. In the famous Kalama Sutta, the Buddha instructed the people in the village of the Kalamas to not follow someone's teaching because the speaker is charismatic or famous, and to not adopt a practice simply because they see other people doing it or because it has a long tradition, but only adopt it for themselves when they see what it develops and that what it develops is good. In the Buddhist tradition, we are encouraged to apply the instructions so that we can discover for ourselves how this path can lead to a greater understanding of the causes of suffering and a realization of the end of suffering. Sometimes we want just the realization of the end of suffering, right? That's the happy part. But usually for that to be reliable, it comes through an understanding of the causes of suffering, which is sometimes hard to see. The Pali term that's usually translated as faith is sadha. But sadha can also be translated as confidence, conviction, and even trust. It essentially means the placing of one's heart upon. This factor of sadha is present in every wholesome state, every act of generosity, every moment of mindfulness, and also the deep absorption states of jhana. The Abhidhamma categorizes it as a universal wholesome factor. With sadha, we are able to place our hearts upon our meditation object, to steady the mind and let it rest in a wholesome perception. So we might consider three aspects to the cultivation of sadha, faith or conviction. The first aspect is a social dimension. It basically asks the question, who can we trust? There are so many teachers, prophets, methods, religious leaders out there. Who can we trust? What instructions should we follow? What makes the Buddha Dhamma? What makes Dharma teachers? What makes the Buddhist Sangha noble or into wise companions? Why should we trust it? Another approach might be to consider an intellectual question. What should be understood? There are many things that we can learn in this life, but not all of them are going to lead to awakening. It may be that a simple understanding of the Four Noble Truths, the causes of suffering, and how causation functions might be enough to penetrate the essential teachings that are liberating. How clearly do we know the cause of suffering? How clearly have we seen that attachment leads to suffering? But there's also a practical question we might ask and consider. How can we act as a result of our convictions? What's our follow-through? Because the follow-through is a mark of a person's integrity. It can be demonstrated by renunciation or equanimity, by generosity, or by a skillful expression of one's emotions. This follow-through or integrity can be expressed through virtue and wise conduct, through perseverance in meditation, even when it's difficult, through diligence, and to taking full advantage of the conducive conditions that we have in this life. Conviction, sadha, and panya, wisdom, are two of the controlling faculties that must balance each other, because both are needed. If faith is too strong, we might become gullible or trust someone foolishly. If wisdom is too strong, we might be fault-finding and overly critical. Faith is a quality that allows us to trust something, something that we may not yet understand, but sense that it's pointing toward something good. You may have seen a movie called Simon Birch some years ago of two boys, a disabled boy and his friend. And they were having a conversation where Simon said to his friend, "Your problem is that you don't have faith." And his friend said, "I have faith. I just want proof to back it up." I think in our practice, we do get little glimmers of the proof that we want to back it up. We get that proof when we notice that patience is growing, that our defilements are lessening, that it becomes easier to let go, and that equanimity is increasing. I trust these changes as verification of the efficacy of meditation. I trust these far more than I trust scientific studies that measure brain waves or reaction times. Trust the path. Trust the path enough to open to new possibility. Trust yourself to open to your own, to be sensitive and to open to your own needs and impressions and intuitions. And trust the practice enough to let it work. In the Buddhist tradition, two kinds of faith are described, blind faith or bright faith, and verified faith. Blind or bright faith is the faith that arises in a moment of inspiration. Sometimes this is in contact with some moving experience or when we're near a powerful teacher. Basically, it's faith that is derived from association with an outside source. It can inspire us. But it's not durable and it's not a sustainable source of energy. We may sometimes feel so inspired and grateful for the teachings, but a depth of verified faith may not be found in a haze of warm feelings and glowing expectations. Verified faith manifests in our actions and in our patience in difficult times. Bright faith can sometimes be taken advantage of, perhaps most notoriously by cult gurus who demand conformity, prohibit criticisms, and might manipulate the faith of their followers through manipulating their moods, through music, relationship, the desire for love or belonging. This desire for approval and acceptance of recognition, the desire to be loved, the desire to be seen, the desire to belong. Although all very natural desires make students vulnerable. And yet association with teachers and wise companions, wise friends, is an integral part of the development of sadha. It should not be neglected out of fear of possible manipulation. The Buddha used the simile of rain. And he described that when the rain pours down in heavy drops, crashes and thunder crashes on the upper mountain, the water flowing down along the slopes fills the mountain clefts, the rifts, the gullies, the little ponds, the big lakes, the little rivers, the big rivers, until finally the great ocean is filled. In the same way, when association with good friends is brought to fulfillment, it leads to hearing the Dhamma. When hearing the Dhamma is brought to fulfillment, it leads to conviction, faith. When conviction and faith is brought to fulfillment, it leads to wise attention. When wise attention is brought to fulfillment, it leads to mindfulness. And the same pattern continues, leads to restraint, it leads to wise conduct, to the seven factors of enlightenment, to insight, and to release. Thus, release is brought about as a fulfillment of a progression, a progressive development that begins with wise association with the wise. And then it leads to the hearing of the Dhamma teachings and a slow development of conviction and the fulfillment of the practice. Periodically, it's very useful to meet with community, to meet with a teacher, to meet with other people who love the Dhamma, to ask questions, to discuss approaches, to settle doubts. But teachers are just practitioners, hopefully with a little bit more experience, a little bit more practice. But basically, we're still slogging along on the same path. We're still learning, still growing. So we must consider what our expectations are for our teachers. And if the relationship with the teacher is distorted by unrealistic expectation, desire, if it's distorted by comparison or projection. Bright faith is a vulnerable form of faith, but it's still important because it can mature into verified faith. And verified faith is a conviction that is known again and again, moment by moment, through our own direct experience. Mature conviction can sustain us through the difficult times. It gives us courage and energy to investigate our experience. It supports an honest inquiry, much deeper than blind belief that might sustain ignorance or fear. A mature conviction develops through growing our capacity to be with our experience, to be present with what is, to inquire into the truth of things, to know our encounter with life fully and thoroughly. We have the capacity to be mindful. You know that. We have the capacity to be alert, awake, present, with the strength of integrity. We can bring that capacity into any situation, even profoundly difficult situations, even when we're in pain. We can be allowing of that pain. We can touch something trustworthy in our relationship to that pain. Verified faith is not a kind of fragile hope. It's not a naive enthusiasm for this path. Hope and enthusiasm can masquerade as a kind of faith, being happy when we're up. But mature confidence, mature faith, is unshaken even through our most vulnerable moments. Thomas Merton said, "True prayer and love is discovered when prayer has become impossible and the heart has turned to stone." Verified faith stands the test of the trials of life. It will not be diminished by criticism. It allows us to stay connected with the aim and purpose of our practice and persevere even if our faith in a particular tradition, a particular technique, a particular teacher, or a particular social institution has been crushed. As practice deepens, we might not notice the dramatic changes in our personality. We might not feel as though we're experiencing our lives very differently, but we might well notice that there is stronger confidence in the path, that faith has deepened. It's this verified conviction that we can clarify and strengthen. And as that strengthens, it strengthens our commitment to the full path, most especially to the foundations of sila, of morality, of clear ethics, of living a non-harming, liberated life. When we see again and again how actions can lead either to happiness or to suffering, and we see how actions affect our own lives and the quality of our own mental states, we have a strong commitment to learn from our own errors, and to learn from our own successes. With clear precepts and sila as a resource, we can recollect the purity of our own conduct and let that inspire us to continue. When we can trust our intentions and trust the integrity of our actions, then we'll find that the basic inclination of our mind is also trustworthy. We'll be able to trust our own minds, ourselves. earlier in the retreat, Phil mentioned an often quoted sutta, which I'd like to refer to again, which is about Venerable Sona. And Venerable Sona had many doubts. In fact, his conviction was really wavering. He had been meditating in seclusion for quite some time and had been doing walking meditation back and forth, to the point that his feet, the soles of his feet, were split and bleeding. And he felt as though he had aroused so much effort. He had tried so hard. He could not be more diligent than this. And yet, even through the best of his efforts, his mind was not free from craving, from clinging, from fear and distress. He had not found peace. And so his mind started to wander, and he thought, my family has wealth. Maybe I'll give up the monastic life. Go back to my family and live a comfortable life. Hey, you know, I can support the monks there anyway, make some merit, do a few good deeds now and then. It won't be a bad life. It'll be okay. Perhaps I ought to leave the order and return to the lay life. That might be better for me. That might be more suitable for me. But the Buddha, with his mental powers, sensed what was going on in the Venerable Sona's mind and magically appeared before Venerable Sona. And that's when he gave him the teachings on balancing effort the way one would tune a stringed instrument. If the effort is too strong, the mind will be tense. If the effort is too lax, we won't be able to maintain a good relationship, a clear relationship with our meditation object. Just like a stringed instrument, if it's too tight, it doesn't sound good, and if it's too loose, it also is not playable. And so he taught Venerable Sona to adjust his effort. And with this teaching on balanced effort, Venerable Sona's faith and wisdom came into balance, and he continued to practice to final liberation. Complete release. This sense of balance is very important at the beginning of the retreat when Phil mentioned it, and again as we approach the ending portion of the retreat. Again and again, we must come into balance. We may try hard and come to our practice with great expectations, but we cannot control the timeline of our progress. Success in this practice is not defined by certain achievements. We don't become successful because we have certain mystical experiences or get into jhana. More importantly, we gradually develop the ability to apply our wise attention with whatever is actually happening. We learn to meet our own lives with mindfulness and wisdom. And through this direct encounter with life, we'll be able to clear the hindrances and uproot the defilements and then cultivate wholesome states. We're not practicing in order to gain spiritual powers, to have lofty personality traits, to have the coolest friends, or to just bliss out every time we sit down. We cannot demand that progress occur in any time frame on our timeline. The core of the practice is wise attention that leads to liberation. And just as Venerable Sona adjusted his effort, we also can adjust our effort and have that effect, the adjustment to our faith. Faith is not something that we are just born with. It actually is developed. It's adjusted. It arises in balanced states of mind. Faith is supported by wisdom. These two controlling faculties, faith and wisdom, must develop in conjunction with each other. It's not just an all or nothing, have it or don't have it. Sometimes conviction slackens in our practice, and we must be able to boost it, to use our wisdom, to recognize when conviction has slackened, when faith has faltered. We might notice it when doubts arise, but if we can catch it a little sooner, it saves us a little bit of trouble. And we re-inspire ourselves. We re-interest ourselves. We encourage ourselves. Now, the tradition offers us several ways to develop faith or to incline the mind toward faith. And the first is to check your attitude. When your practice feels stuck, check your attitude. What's your motivation? Why are you practicing? Has a selfish motivation crept in, a selfish desire to get something? Or can you be practicing for the benefit and love of all beings? We can also reflect on the Buddha, on enlightened beings, on qualities of the awakened mind, or on the triple refuge of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I love to practice the recollection of the Buddha in particular, to let the mind dwell with a steady attention on qualities that are worthy to respect, to let the mind bring to mind some of those qualities of the Buddha. Perhaps his the profound purity of his mind. The fact that he discovered this path. He didn't just practice it, he discovered it. I mean, it's hard enough to practice it when we have teachings. Imagine discovering it, slogging along. Keeping his aim so clear in mind until he found the way. And then remembered how he did it and taught it. I think about the unselfish teaching. It might have been more comfortable for him to kick back a bit, but instead he taught for 45 years. We can also steady the mind with any wholesome object. Loving kindness, various thoughts of virtue. Yesterday, I think it was yesterday, I talked about a sequence of a conditioned development of happiness to and concentration. And the same sequence, or a similar one at least, appears in relationship to recollecting the Buddha, the Buddha's qualities. So I want to read that to you. When a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. His mind is straight with the Tathagata as its object. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration of the meaning, the inspiration of the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is gladdened, rapture arises. For one uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm. One calm in body feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. We can also find support from good friends. We often find this by coming on retreat. You know, it may not be our buddies that we go out to the movies and restaurants with, but to share in the silence, we are serving as each other's good friend. We might feel good friendship just by reading the suttas and reading a story about one of the late great disciples and feeling a kinship there. We might attend sitting groups or meet with a teacher periodically and in some way enliven our engagement with the Dhamma by connecting with other people who love the Dhamma. We can connect with nature, the natural world. Get outside. Okay, so this might be going deep into nature, into the mountains, or going to the a camping trip or something. But we don't have to go so far. I think almost any time we unplug from the electronic world, turn our cell phones off, disconnect from the internet, and just plunk ourselves down in the middle of a field, we'll see nature. Might just be your front lawn. Sit on your front lawn if you have a front lawn. Watch the bugs. Watch the birds. Go to a vacant lot if there isn't a big forest near your home. Find life anywhere and just watch it. It can be very uplifting just to see the sparkles on a dewdrop. Or to take a breath in and a breath out in the cold, crisp air and feel that crispness. We can develop wonder, awe, inspiration in the blessings that we have in this life, in particular, the precious opportunities that we have to practice the Dhamma and cultivate gratitude for those opportunities, gratitude for lineage, gratitude for the circumstances that we have to practice, and appreciate the selfless generations of translators, teachers, monastics, practitioners who've preserved this tradition through countless personal sacrifices over countless generations. We can appreciate the work that is done today to develop meditation groups, to offer retreats, to develop meditation centers, so that we have places to practice, so that we have conditions where we can share the teachings and allow the Dhamma to take root in our land. We can support Dhamma books, lectures, centers, retreats, events. All these are Dhamma gifts, gifts of the Dhamma that are produced by everyone involved. When your faith is low, like Venerable Sona, whose feet hurt, it's very easy at those moments when our feet hurt that we might want to go home too. Doubt can arise. We might think we can't do it. And as soon as we have those thoughts, often we stop putting forth the energy that's actually needed to be mindful and present. And if we lose our inspiration and we lose our energy and our enthusiasm, then it's very likely that more hindrances will fill the mind. But it's not uncommon at some point in one's practice to feel a bit discouraged. This easily happens in structured systems like jhana practice, because sometimes we think, oh, there are four jhanas, and so I should be at this one by this day of the retreat. And it just doesn't usually happen that way. If we rely upon progress like a ladder of success to confirm and validate ourselves as a capable and worthy person, then we will likely suffer when our expectations are not met. But the successful accomplishment of the meditative stages is not a sign of spiritual success, and it certainly is not a sign of our own self-worth, or for that matter, the effectiveness of the teachers or the importance of the teachings. We must let go of the tendency to compare our progress with what we think it should be, to let go of the comparisons that reinforce conceit that are built and on the duality of success and failure. When these comparing thoughts arise, it's time to recognize simply that comparing has arisen. Comparing only can arise when the factor of sadha has weakened. And so we must bring mindfulness to that comparing before it proliferates into doubting, and strengthen our conviction and confidence in the path. Strengthen it not through forcing ourselves to believe, but strengthen it through the power of seeing for ourselves, of bringing mindfulness to the moment and seeing for ourselves what is true. Sometimes, though, we might need to make a leap of faith. I think you'll find that this path is actually a trustworthy path to leap onto. I think I'd like to end with a chant on the recollection of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. And then we'll just sit for a few minutes. The Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the Enlightened One, the Blessed One. Iti piso bhagava araham sama sambuddho vija charana sampano sukato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati satta deva manutsanang buddho bhagavati. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise. Suakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatam vedita puinyuhiti. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way, that is, the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho, ujjupatipanno bhagavato savakasangho, nayapatipanno bhagavato savakasangho, samichipatipanno bhagavato savakasangho, ya idam chatari purisa yugani atta purisa pugala esa bhagavato savakasangho. Ahunayo, pahunayo, dakyanayo, anjali karaniyo, anuttaram punyaketam lokasati.